This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're here to discuss this past week's important news with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
We have had an extraordinary development in the ongoing saga surrounding the Iran nuclear deal. This time, Iran is issuing a rather pushy warning to Europe. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, the United States has been out of the nuclear deal for a year or so. And what we've seen in that time is a desire by the Iranians to really push the European Union to find ways to skirt around the United States financial sanctions on Iran. And Europe has said that it is trying to work around them, trying to create different ways in which they can still do deals with Iran without being impacted by the United States secondary sanctions. And apparently the Iranians aren't too pleased with the progress that Europe has made. And so they decided this Wednesday with a statement that they are now going to suspend a couple of clauses to the nuclear deal. They are going to break the nuclear deal themselves. They're going to allow them to enrich more than 300 kilograms of uranium. They're also going to allow themselves to have more heavy water than they're allowed to under the nuclear deal. And following that, they've also issued a warning to Europe saying that you've got 60 days to figure out a way for our economy to be opened up further to Europe, or we're going to start up our Iraq nuclear facility once again. Our centrifuges will start spinning once again and ramp up our production of nuclear-related material. And so this is, you know, this is shocking in a way because Iran, it has been in Iran's interest to stay into the nuclear deal as long as possible. But now it seems like they are fed up with Europe not acting fast enough, and so they're going to get out unless Europe changes its mind.
It shows Iran has, at least it considers itself, having quite a bit of leverage in this relationship.
It does, and I mean, for the longest time, we've seen Europe bend over backwards to try and help Iran stay in this nuclear deal. It also shows maybe there is probably some extended pressure upon the government in Iran is right now as well, because the people are suffering in Iran, the Iranian economy is suffering, and so they're probably trying to push that blame towards Europe, saying, Europe, you're not holding up your end of the bargain, and so if we're not getting any financial benefits out of it, we're going to leave as well. But what's really interesting about this is the nature of the way that the announcement was given. Basically, Europe they were put off by this because it came in the form of a threat. It wasn't just that if you don't do something, we're out. It was also if you don't do something, in the statement that Rouhani gave the president, he also said that curtailing the migrants that are going to come up into Europe. We'll be doing a lot to stop drug smuggling that's coming up into Europe. That type of thing might cease. We also might get a little bit unpredictable, is what he said. And so these
are interesting word choice there.
Yeah, and this is like a serious threat to Europe, or blackmail, basically, is what everybody's calling it. And so the Europeans, though, their response might have surprised the Iranians. This is what they said. This was a couple of days after those threats were given. It said this was a statement from the EU representative and then also foreign ministers of France, Germany, and UK. They said this: we reject any ultimatums. Mm-hmm. And that's what they see this as, an ultimatum from Iran, and will assess Iran's compliance on the basis of Iran's performance regarding its nuclear commitments and such. And so you can say what you want. You can say that you're going to do this, that, and the other thing, or pull out if we don't act. We don't appreciate that blackmail, and that's what we see it as. And we are going to judge you on what you do. We are not going to bend over to submit to your rhetorical blackmail at this point.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about the European response to this, but just returning to Iran's statement for a moment, the fact that they essentially said, we are going to return to the activities, nuclear-related activities, that you would be hard-pressed to look at and say these are peace-oriented activities. I mean, even for them to be, they're talking about specific actions that they're going to take, and they say that our behavior could become unpredictable. It seems like there's an implied threat that this is, they want to become a military nuclear power, which they've always been coy about in insisting that that isn't the purpose for it. But in a way, it's like the mask came off a bit here.
It did, for sure. But I would say I would temper that a little bit in that Iran, these first little breaking of the agreement, let's say, of the nuclear deal, they are softer elements of the nuclear agreement. These are a couple of things, at least before the 60 days expire, that could be used towards peaceful purposes, nuclear material, nuclear development for peaceful purposes. But the ultimatum that they... this won't stop after 60 days either, meaning we are going to ramp up the production that could lead to a nuclear weapon or be used for dual purposes, I guess, certainly does show that the mask is lifted. I mean, this won't come as a surprise, I think, for Europe, because Europe, France, the UK, Germany, they were involved in the negotiations of the actual nuclear deal. And it was widely reported at the time that France was standing in the United States' way at having a nuclear deal with Iran. President Obama wanted the nuclear deal. He was willing to give a lot. And it was France that was pushing back. The Europeans were actually pushing back against the Americans. And so this won't be surprising, these type of tactics by the Iranians. They did them effectively to get the nuclear deal signed. They basically said to the U.S., don't help out in Syria. Don't go in and counter what we want to do in Syria, or else we're walking away from the nuclear deal. The sunset clause, what was put into the nuclear deal, was right there at the last minute. And Iran said, we're walking away unless we have this sunset clause, which allowed, you know, their ramp up of the process to produce a nuclear weapon after 10 years. That was added right at the last minute. And France eventually bent over to the United States to allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so they are fully aware of Iran's blackmail tactics. Mm-hmm. And they're basically saying right now, we know that your goal has been to produce a nuclear weapon. They've known that all along. It's not like the Europe or France thinks that Iran didn't want a nuclear weapon. Everybody knows that they did. And so they are basically holding tight to the nuclear deal, saying, hey, you don't change it one bit. If you actually make a move, not just what you're saying you're going to change it, we will put our own sanctions on you. That's what the Europe said.
So you can't see what's happening here. If you've been looking at Bible prophecy, if you've been following the trumpet, see Iran making this kind of ultimatum against Europe, and seeing Europe actually stiffening its spine and responding the way that they have, without recognizing that we're looking at something that is very much in line with what we've been prophesying will happen.
For sure, because up to this point, Europe has kind of been more dovish than the United States, at least during President Trump's rule, and they have. I mean, Europe has faced this dichotomy. We don't really like Iran getting progress towards a nuclear bomb, but we don't want to follow the United States under President Trump, because we don't like him either, and we're kind of fed up with this relationship with the United States. And so for the past year, they've sided kind of with Iran against the United States. Now it seems that they are coming around further to the United States' position, a hardening position on Iran. And that's what the Bible says. The Bible talks about a clash of civilizations between Iran and not the United States, but between Iran and Europe. So at some point, there's going to have to be a break of this familial relationship between Iran and Europe. And we are seeing that over the nuclear issue. Iran feels like it can push around Europe, because there have been signs that they might be willing to be pushed around a little bit to stay against what the United States is doing. But Europe is announcing you can only go so far with this, Iran. We are aware of your intent, and we aren't going to latch you to get a nuclear weapon or go further down that line. The Bible speaks, as I said, about this clash of civilizations. We have a trend article that people can go to really understand this. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations. Europe is going to get to the point that it says to Iran, we have had enough of your threats. We've had enough of your pushy foreign policy. And the Bible says they're going to be willing to do something about it. And this stiffening of their spine in terms of the nuclear deal here and basically telling Iran, you don't tell us what to do, shows that that attitude is already in existence inside Europe.
All right, go check that article out, Why the Trumpet Watches Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations. You can find it on our trends page just by clicking on trends at the top of the trumpet.com. We appreciate that very much. Brent, we'll go over to Asia now for a second story. Hopes for a peaceful resolution to tensions with North Korea took an apparent step backward this week. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, North Korea test-fired two short-range ballistic missiles yesterday, with one of them flying about 260 miles, and the other one flew about 170 miles. And this was actually the second time this week that the North has conducted a missile test. On Saturday, there was a similar one with short-range missiles once again. So it's really noteworthy considering that before this week, North Korea hadn't conducted a single missile test since November of 2017. So that was about a year and a half ago that they ended this series of just increasingly provocative tests that they've been conducting. And the main reason why they brought that to an end back in 2017 was because the North started to work with the United States to try to come to some kind of a deal about denuclearizing North Korea in exchange for having all those sanctions that are on it lifted. And it looked like there was a chance for some progress to be made. But then in February, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump, and the talks collapsed. They failed to agree because President Trump wanted full sanctions relief in exchange for full denuclearization, whereas Kim Jong-un wanted just the heaviest sanctions to be lifted in exchange for partial denuclearization, which is kind of worthless, really, when you're talking about nuclear weapons. So you can see why President Trump walked away from those talks, and you can see why the talks really collapsed. But now Kim seems to be signaling with these tests that he's very unhappy that months and months and months have gone by with no tangible results from all of this. So the two tests this week, they don't violate North Korea's kind of self-imposed moratorium on long-range missile tests that Kim Jong-un announced last April. But these short-range missiles could still reach South Korea and Japan. Mm-hmm. So they put about 175 million people who are at least notionally allied with the United States within their range. And these tests just show that the situation there on the Korean Peninsula is becoming more volatile, and it could very quickly be, right back to that level of tensions that we saw there a couple of years ago.
Tell us too about this cargo ship that the United States seized from North Korea.
Yes, yesterday, just after this North Korean missile launch was confirmed, the United States announced that it had seized a North Korean ship. They say the ship was shipping coal from North Korea in violation of United Nations sanctions. So this is a 17,000-ton cargo ship. It's called the Honest Wise. It's North Korea's second-largest ship. And it was actually back in July when this happened. It was stopped in Indonesia and found to be violating those sanctions. So the Justice Department gave the U.S. ownership of it through a civil forfeiture. And that's the first time the United States has ever impounded a North Korean cargo vessel for violating sanctions. But the fact that the U.S. just now announced this thing that happened, close to a year ago there, they just announced it hours after this missile launch yesterday. It might have been the U.S. kind of reminding the North of the kind of power that it has. But in either case, these developments, I think, show that this period of relative calm that we've had there on the Korean Peninsula, it's a very fragile calm, and it could be starting to crack.
One thing that we've talked about quite a bit with North Korea is just how much the China in particular has used North Korea as a means of keeping America off balance. And, you know, the fact that North Korea couldn't do really much of anything without the sponsorship of China. What's your view of, say, these latest provocations in the bigger picture of what's happening in Asia?
Well, yes, I think that without Chinese support, without Russian support, there would be very little to prevent the United States, for example, from being a little more aggressive with trying to effect regime change there. The U.S. doesn't want to get, you know, go into a full-blown war with Russia and China, so they mostly avoid that kind of thing. But it really is those nations. It's China mostly and Russia to a lesser degree that are really allowing it to North Korea to stay afloat. Just a month ago, we saw Kim Jong-un meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He went to Russia for his very first visit there. We've seen Kim Jong-un meet with the Chinese leaders several times over the last few years. And also, these launches this week came just as the U.S. and China are in these kind of last-ditch talks about trying to avoid this huge escalation in the trade war, which it looks like they were not successful in avoiding that escalation, but maybe the North was sort of trying to increase its leverage on one or both of them, partly with this, just kind of reminding everybody, by the way, we're still here. And maybe that's a Chinese design as well to kind of distract the U.S. We've seen China many times over the years rely on North Korea as a bit of a distraction, a louder, more belligerent, less powerful kind of aggressor, while it can more quietly get away with doing some of the same things.
Yeah. So putting this in prophetic context, this is definitely something that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has talked about quite a bit over the years.
It is, yes. He's talked about it several times, and back in September of 2017, at probably the height of the tensions, at least in the recent era, he said that even though North Korea often kind of rattles its saber more loudly than any other Asian power, he said that the world should be far more concerned about Russia and China than about North Korea, because it's actually Russia and China who are the ones who enable all that saber rattling and all that belligerence and duplicity. And just I'll read a quote from what he said at that time. He said, "The Bible's prophecies show that in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely. And Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." And the prophecies that he's talking about there are mostly in Ezekiel 38. And Daniel 11 and the book of Revelation. If you take a look at all these, it shows that in the end time, Russia and China will lead a powerful Asiatic military bloc. And we have an in-depth trend article called "Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower" that goes through all these prophecies very powerfully and just shows what all these tensions are leading to and the hope, really, that's ultimately tied to it.
All right. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And speaking of this threat from China, tensions between the United States and China over trade heated up this week, as Jeremiah just mentioned. The evidence is that China is positioning itself to win the long game. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
U.S. and Chinese officials met yesterday to discuss terms of trying to dial back the escalating trade war between the two nations. The negotiations did not go well, and so the U.S. increased tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods up to 25% today. So China's already made a statement that they're disappointed with the increase on tariffs and expect to enact some countermeasures soon. They haven't said what those countermeasures are, but under the table, they've actually been enacting some very long-term countermeasures for a number of years now. And for those paying attention, we actually saw one of those countermeasures come to the forelight at the beginning of this week. They had their presidential elections in Panama on Sunday, and the new president-elect in Panama actually had given a warning in his speech after his post-election speech, his victory speech, that the United States needs to pay more attention to Panama, or China's going to push it out of that sphere of influence in that nation. And what he's talking about is about 2 years ago, Panama finally relented and refused to recognize Taiwan as a sovereign nation, something that China had been pressuring them to do for some time. Once Panama kind of kowtowed to China in that regard, the Chinese have just started pouring in investment money, primarily infrastructure projects, all sorts of just like bridges and dams and roads and other Chinese sponsored infrastructure, just developing Panama. And that seems I guess that seems really like a really nice thing to do, but that the Chinese aren't necessarily doing it out of the goodness, the pure altruistic goodness of their hearts. For the one, this was kind of a carrot and stick to get Panama to not recognize Taiwan, and for two, they're trying to just really pull Panama into China's sphere of orbit. China is already very well invested in many Latin American nations, actually of the especially Central American nations, and of the Central American nations, Panama's historically been the most pro-American ever since President Theodore Roosevelt dug the Panama Canal there in 1914. Panama has been fairly closely tied with the U.S. economy, which gets to probably even more than the Taiwan issue, the bigger issue of what China is trying to do in Panama by all these infrastructure projects. They've already got Chinese-owned companies running the toll booths on both sides of the Panama Canal. If you can make Panama a staunch Chinese ally, you have Chinese influence over this very strategic trade route. I mean, 8% of the world's oil traffic goes through the Panama Canal, in addition to millions and millions of dollars of other goods.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's interesting to look at what China is doing here in light of what we've been talking about with, say, like Russia's infiltration into Venezuela. You see these Asian giants that are essentially moving into America's backyard. China's influence has been growing ever since it gained control over those ports of entry, as you mentioned, some years ago. But the strategic complications and the fact that this could be used as a massive weapon against the United States is really a threat that the U.S. should be taking very seriously.
Right, because we're looking at this in context of a trade war. And right now, the big headlines are about, well, they enacted this tariff on this, the U.S. enacted this tariff on China, China enacted this tariff on the U.S. It keeps making it more expensive for the others to buy the others' goods, and just escalating where the trade between the two nations is declining. But I mean, if you want another way to win a trade war, a little bit more militaristic way mm-hmm. to win a trade war, is to seize control of the trade routes and control what trade goods get to pass through it. So now it's not so much, oh, well, we're not, Americans aren't buying this good because it's too expensive because of this tariff. It's more that, like, Americans aren't buying this good because China shut down
right.
The trade route that good has to get through to get there.
So this announcement by the Panamanian president points directly to Bible prophecies about sea gates.
Right, because in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, the late Herbert W. Armstrong even used this to prove where Israel was in the end time, the biblical nation of Israel. God promised Abraham that if he obeyed his statutes and laws, that he would give his descendants the gates of his enemies. And then on a national scale, a gate is just a narrow point of entrance or exit. And so looking at a global scale, it's places like the Panama Canal. That's like it's a sea gate. It's a gateway for trade goods. And the fact that Britain and America collectively controlled pretty much every sea gate on the planet 50 years ago is proof that he makes the point in that book that if you didn't know anything else about the history of America and Britain and Israel, I mean, if you look at that history, you can trace the descendants of ancient Israel to America and Britain, where they settled in the end time. But he said, even if you didn't study any of that, just the fact that God made this promise that they would possess these sea gates and America and Britain possess these gates showed that they are the end time nations of Israel. But then there's another prophecy in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, that's saying that if you disobey my laws, not only are you going to lose these gates, but they're going to be used, your enemies are going to take them and use them against you.
Yeah.
And so that's something we've been watching very closely for this organization for several decades now, is the loss of those gates.
Yeah.
And that's what the Panamanian president is getting at when he's talking about that if America doesn't pay attention to China, they're going to lose out control over the Panama Canal. And then you lose that gate. You lose that gate. And like I said, trade war becomes not so much about tariffs anymore, but like, can goods actually get to the United States when your enemies control your gates?
Right. Well, we have a chapter about that in our booklet, He Was Right. Go check out that booklet about Herbert W. Armstrong, who talked about this. Andrew mentioned his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That's also another excellent resource. But this booklet, He Was Right, just goes through this and several other prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong made that we're seeing come to pass today. You can find that in the literature library at thetrumpet.com. And also we'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's Trumpet Hour. Thanks for that, Andrew. An election in Turkey some weeks ago yielded a result that Turkey's strongman leader did not like. So he announced this week that the election didn't count. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think this will come as no surprise to anyone that Turkey is not a great democracy. I mean, the stakes were high on that election in March 31st. There were local elections, but Erdogan himself once said, whoever wins Istanbul wins Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's quite an embarrassment when then his party goes in and loses that election. So he twisted the arm of the electoral authorities over there. They're going to rerun the election now. And not only that, you know, because there were some problems last time, to make sure that there's no question that this is free and fair, and to make it absolutely clear that there's no interference whatsoever, instead of the normal internal bureaucrats overseeing the election, it will be members of Erdogan's own political party. they're going to step in there and, you know, for the benefit of the whole nation, really, you know, make sure that this is a free and fair election.
Apart from that, how it is kind of laughable how they're working this out, or how Erdogan is working this out, I think it does speak to just the boldness of some of the Turkish population still, because they've seen what's happened to Erdogan's enemies internally, how they are, because of the great purge that he's continuing throwing these anti-Erdogan people in jail very often, academics and such, to still have around 50% of Istanbul come out and vote against Erdogan's party is putting themselves in a position that they could be eventually sidelined by the government in the future. I think this is interesting because while we tend to think of Turkey as being solidly in Erdogan's camp in the sense that he does rule by fiat now, I don't know if Bible prophecy is fully determined on whether Erdogan is going to rule from here on out. We know that there is going to be a relationship between Europe and Turkey. And right now we have a Turkish leader that is pushing the nation towards political Islam. He believes in Islam, Sharia ruling over the population. And that might be anathema to Europe. It is, basically. And so while this is a sign that it looks like he's consolidating his power and it shows how much power he has, there might yet be a pretty big change in Turkish politics going forward. There is a population, a large part of the population, that is not happy with these moves.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing to watch. I mean, you know, we had Erdogan had his coup against him going back several years now. And back then, Germany was not very supportive of Erdogan. And he's even accused, I believe, some in Germany's government of supporting the coup. Since that coup attempt, relations between Erdogan and Germany, they need each other, so they've still been there.
Right.
But at the same time, they have been much more frosty than they were in the past. And then when he came out on Monday with this decision, the United States, for example, wasn't all that critical of his decision to rerun this election. Germany was. Germany was one of probably the most outspoken outside party there, condemning Erdogan for doing a rerun of this vote. Meanwhile, of course, Germany's all for doing reruns of the votes when it's within the European Union. But the point is that, yeah, Germany looks very suspicious of Erdogan, and the evidence does seem that they would welcome a change. And so this could be he's taking control over the country even more, but at the same time, he could be doing that because of this weakness that might be developing.
Well, the fact that they've maintained this relationship in spite of these kinds of shenanigans on Erdogan's part does show just how much mutually these two entities need one another. Whether or not he stays in power, the prophecy that there will be some kind of alignment in the future does seem to be secure in the way that this is unfolding. But very interesting to see how Erdogan is wielding his power. I think the point that you make, Brent, about just the courage of the people of Turkey to stand up to that is quite something as well. But we appreciate you bringing that to us. And we do have an article on thetrumpet.com called Istanbul's Election Results Declared Invalid. That article will be going up on the Trumpet site on Monday, so you can watch for that. We appreciate that very much. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, an escalation in tensions between Iran and America, and why the discussion about reparations for slavery is such a bad idea. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke on Wednesday's program about America sending an aircraft carrier into the Persian Gulf to counter Iran. Hostilities between these nations has continued to play out this week. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, we talked about this on Wednesday's program, at least the very initial stages of this ramping up of tensions between the United States and Iran. It started off with Mr. Bolton's decision that he was going to release a statement saying that an aircraft carrier is going to hasten its journey to the Persian Gulf by 2 weeks, and it is going there because of threats that are being placed on American forces. And as it came out later on in the week, there was a couple of threats, it seems, to U.S. forces in Kuwait and U.S. forces in Iraq, and also U.S. or not necessarily U.S. forces in Yemen, but that they might, that the Iranians might mobilize some of its Houthi proxies in Yemen to target shipping through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. So there were numerous reasons for the United States to come out and decide, let's get an aircraft carrier right there. They've also shipped in or flown in three B-52 bombers. They're actually in Qatar right now. And so the Iranians, for all this, have also said that they are aware of this United States increase of actions, and they're not going to back down. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Mr. Pompeo, was going to visit Germany and talk about numerous issues with the German government. He decided to cancel that trip and make a surprise visit to Iraq to visit the Iraqi government and basically tell the Iraqi government, you put a leash on the Iranian-backed militias that are a part of your army, and you say to them, you do not attack U.S. forces, because we are going to be very forceful with our counterattack on the Iranian-backed forces.
Well, that type of language to the Iraqis hasn't worked so well in recent months.
You're right, it hasn't. But at the same time, I would say there is still a genuine fear of Mr. Trump putting the money where his mouth is and actually acting very firmly. Now, what's interesting also about this is that all the statements that the United States gave in terms of saying, Iran, hold back your dogs, hold back the proxies, because that's how Iran likes to work. They like to use proxy forces to try and hide the fact that a state actor is behind it. The United States has said, not one of your proxies attack us either, because we will retaliate against you. We will retaliate against Iran, the IRGC. That's who we will target. And so this type of rhetoric, I mean, history kind of proves that Iran doesn't test this when they actually think there is going to be a response.
Yep.
And so while the world is, you know, talking, as even we said on Wednesday, about how the U.S. is leading the Middle East to war, with this show of force, this actually kind of backs down from, or it leads to a de-escalation, really, or at least the chances of war breaking out being far less.
Yeah.
But it does still speak to this kind of situation in Iran where they might be ready to act militarily against United States interests and see if the United States will respond.
It's so fascinating to see the U.S. administration treating Iran as tough as it is. I mean, in a lot of ways, it has been mostly rhetoric. It's been economic pressure. There hasn't been a whole lot militarily. Sending B-52s, sending an aircraft carrier group into the Persian Gulf definitely demonstrates a show of force unlike the U.S. has shown for quite some time. But yeah, the way that Iran responds, as you said, they've shown through history that they do actually respect this kind of demonstration in terms of their actions. Obviously, there's a lot of bluster and there's a lot of talk in response to this. But how does this play out as we're looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy and the long-term expectations? Right now, there are really a number of factors that suggest that the way that the United States is conducting itself run counter to that to a certain degree, or they are maybe postponing that day of reckoning that we're expecting according to prophecy.
That's right. We obviously expect Iran to be the power that pushes the world towards World War III because of its pushy foreign policy and its offensive actions. The thing that happened this week, I would say, even though the United States is showing a powerful force there in the Middle East, Iran might be changing its calculus in some ways. There are plenty of commentators out there that are saying that the Iranians were happy to sit tight until President Trump was out of there. Let's not do too much to destabilize the Middle East. Let's kind of hold back a little bit. Let's stay within the nuclear deal because we're going to have a Democratic president soon, and we'll get back into the nuclear deal. But what some commentators are saying, because of these threats are real, Iran looks like they were going to act against United States assets in the region. They might have determined that President Trump is going to win the next election and that there's going to be another 6 years of this American policy. And so the 6 years, the Iranian regime is not going to survive the type of sanctions that the United States is putting on the regime. And so maybe they have decided to jump ship of the original policy and become more offensive in their warfare. And so we'll see how this plays out. We know eventually they're going to pursue that policy of push against the West, against Europe. We might be having a turning point right now where they have determined to pursue that earlier than their kind of restrained actions that we've seen over, let's say, the last 2 years.
Well, that's an intriguing theory. What would you direct people to read if they want more information about this that might help them contextualize this prophetically?
Yeah, I think it would be very good to just, I put up an article this week just arguing the point or looking at this point of, is America the real aggressor in the Middle East? I forget the exact title, but it's on the front page right now of The Trumpet, somewhere there. And it really goes into show the Bible prophecy does say that it is Iran, not the United States, that is the cause for the destabilization. And that's what we should be looking for going forward in terms of biblical prophecy.
You got the title right, Brent. Is the United States the aggressor in the Middle East? You can find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that. A new report by the U.S. Department of Defense says that one of the world's strongest submarine fleets is being created by China. This is a development with a lot of important strategic ramifications. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the DOD has just released its annual report on China's military power. And as you said, one of the big conclusions was that the Chinese Navy is quickly building just one of the world's strongest submarine fleets. And they say that this fleet now includes a credible sea-based nuclear deterrent. So the Chinese Navy now has 50 conventional attack submarines and 12 nuclear models. And six of those nuclear models are the Type 094 submarines that can carry and launch up to 12 very advanced nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles. So China's really now among the very few nations that can launch nuclear strikes from beneath the waves. Before this accomplishment with China, I think the list was just France, India, Russia, the U.S., the U.K., and probably Israel that could do that. And submarine nuclear launch capability greatly reduces the chance that a nation could have its nuclear forces wiped out by an enemy in a preemptive strike. Because if any country with this capability is attacked, its hidden submarines can retaliate. Mm-hmm. So these submarines it's actually one of those kind of ironic reasons why we have never seen any nuclear powers trying to defeat one of their nuclear armed enemies with a massive first strike, because they know if they do, there would be retaliation from some undisclosed location under the waves. So it's a big advance for China in that regard. And this report notes that in addition to a nuclear deterrence, China's increasing focus on submarines is intended to help the country, quote, achieve maritime superiority within the first island chain. That's the chain of islands that extend from Japan down to the Philippines and Indonesia. And the Chinese feel that it's critical for their national security to be able to control everything from from mainland China to those islands, mm-hmm. which includes the South China Sea, that very strategic waterway that we talk about so often. The South China Sea has been called the world's most valuable commercial artery. And with China's submarine fleets growing more, so much more powerful, they'll be able to just tighten their grip on the South China Sea much more.
As China increases in this capability, how does the U.S. counter that? What's America's submarine deterrent look like?
It doesn't look good. A lot of military experts in the U.S. have been trying to kind of sound the alarm about the tipping scales here for quite a long time. In 2016, the U.S. Navy said it needs 66 attack submarines to be able to kind of maintain its undersea advantage. And as of last month, it had 51 operational units. So it's quite a discrepancy there. And there's an analyst named David Axe who just wrote about this in the National Interest this week, and he said, quote, America's submarine shortfall, which has been decades in the making, likely will get worse before it gets better. Even if the Navy could afford more subs, which it can't, it lacks shipyards to build them, end quote. So this is, it's pretty sobering, I think, to see that as China's submarine forces are multiplying and getting a lot stronger and more advanced, the exact opposite is happening with the U.S. We're retiring them faster mm-hmm. than we're replacing them. And that's just going to make it much harder for the United States to prevent China from asserting power over the South China Sea.
You did a good job of explaining just how this power, the fact that a nation would have a nuclear submarine power, how much that enhances its overall power and standing within the world. And when you marry that to what we've seen China undertaking strategically, we were talking earlier about its taking over Panama Canal and putting itself in a position where it would be able to besiege the United States. You really get a sense of just how big of a threat this could prove to be.
Yes, it's an enormous threat, and it seems that it's largely unnoticed by most of us here in the West. We still feel, you know, we spoke on the show last week about presidential candidate Joe Biden saying that we don't need to worry about China. So it's it's kind of strange to see that. But Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has said that all of these moves from China, its rising military might and its tightening grip on the South China Sea, is steering the world toward war. You know, he wrote a 2016 article by that title. One part of it says, "Since World War II, America's protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world," referring to the South China Sea. "Now, the American military is retreating, and China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war." End quote. And then he explains that his analysis of the South China Sea there is founded on Bible prophecy. He mentions Deuteronomy 28:52, which Andrew spoke about in a lot of depth in the first half there. But that's where God warns the nations of Israel, which are mostly the modern U.S. and U.K., that if they reject him, if they reject his law, then he'll give control of the world's strategic sea gates, which includes some strategic shipping lanes like those in the South China Sea, to their enemies. And so, you know, he also mentions how China's rising naval might will help them to help that transition to happen. So this submarine, you know, these balances tipping there, it's really going to hasten the fulfillment of those prophecies.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article about this that you can find on the front page of the Trumpet. China's submarine force is coming up fast. You can also find that article by Gerald Flurry, "China is Steering the World Toward War." It's linked to in his article, and also we'll put a link to both of those in the show notes for today's program. Thank you, Jeremiah. A vote in Germany's parliament this past week received little attention, but it has important prophetic ramifications. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I mean, it's not by itself, it's not really a big story. Nothing's changed, nothing's happened, but it underscores a very important prophetic change or prophetic event. So Germany, every couple of years, their parliament has to approve all military missions, and their parliament signed off to keep some of those military missions ticking over this week. And a lot of them are in Africa. It's just an important reminder of how much Germany is doing there. They have several hundred troops in Mali, both supporting a United Nations mission there and also a European Union training mission. They have a mission in Somalia where they are working to combat piracy in the region. They also have some missions that were not signed off by the European Parliament by the German Parliament, because they didn't ask for them to be signed off. The Germany has some other missions as well in Africa, which it claims, because they're training missions, it doesn't need Germany's parliament to sign off on. Some parties are claiming they're unconstitutional, but they're in a number of other different places like Niger and the Cameroon. So you're seeing just a continued involvement of Germany in this region.
Well, as you said, seeing Germany activate its military in Africa isn't something that a lot of people would express much interest in, but it looked at from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, it's actually quite significant.
That's right. Like Brent was talking about in the first half, one of the key prophecies that we're watching is this clash between the King of the North and the King of the South, this European power and radical Islam led by Iran. And what do we see Germany doing already, and France already, making these military deployments to combat radical Islam in North Africa? And then the more you drill down in that prophecy in Daniel 11 that talks about the king of the south, the more specific it gets. You know, it brings North Africa in. It talks about Libya and Ethiopia being, you know, battlegrounds for this confrontation, allied with the king of the south, then invaded by the king of the north. And we see, you know, Germany already working all around these places. Even the use of the world, it says the King of the North will come at the King of the South like a whirlwind. And you start to look into what that word whirlwind means. And it's all about, you know, coming from, you know, surrounding the King of the South, coming from all around Iran. And with Germany setting up all of these bases, also having a very significant military deployment in Afghanistan, you can really see where they're putting that prep work in. They're forging very strong relations with the militaries of all these other countries, you know, training significant portions of these militaries and really setting up the foundations for the fulfillment of that prophecy in Daniel chapter 11.
All right. Well, we will leave that there. Thank you for that, Richard. One final story. More and more Democratic candidates for America's presidency are declaring their support for making reparations for slavery. Will this actually solve America's race problems? For the answer, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is shaping out to be a potential key issue for the 2020 presidential elections, with a number of Democratic candidates, including Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Julian Castro, already having come out and said that they'd be in favor of some sort of reparations to African Americans for slavery. Now, they've had a number of opinion pieces, some of them even coming out this week, that trying to debate the pros and cons of this policy. But it looks like it would be quite dangerous, a quite dangerous talking point that could make race relations and will make race relations in America much worse. Because one thing you have to consider, and I think most of the politicians talking about this know this when they say this, it's a vote getting ploy, because there are about 26% of Americans that they can determine that are in favor of, or at least vocally in favor of reparations.
26% is still quite a phenomenal number.
It's
of
a
people
phenomenal
that are,
number.
Yeah.
But they
and I would imagine that just the way that this is being pushed into the mainstream by these Democratic presidential candidates, that number is already significantly higher than it would have been even just a year ago.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was a year, but that does sound like it's probably true. But the thing is, a lot of that 26%, it's just kind of a gut reaction. They're like, oh, Well, slavery was bad, so we should do something about it.
Yeah.
The politicians espousing it they're trying to tap into that vote demographic.
It's a good applause line.
It's a good applause line, but they must know that the logistics of it are impossible.
Right.
Because you're looking at it as like, how would this actually work? Is you can't give reparations to former slaves because the last one died in 1971. You can't just do whites owe money to blacks, because that would mean that someone from Poland who comes here this month owes someone from Somalia who comes here this month money, even though neither of them were even in America until very recently.
Right. Not to mention the fact that a whole lot of the whites in the country fought on the side of the North, which actually, in a sense, paid reparations for slavery already in their
right.
own lives.
I've heard that there's probably maybe as few as 5% of white Americans are even descended from slave owners. So you'll get some of the more militant people demanding reparations, like Keith Ellison will say that, well, we're going to have to do like an Ancestry.com or a DNA test to try to figure out which blacks are descended from slaves and which whites are descended from slave owners. But it's been so many decades, and there's been so much intermarriage that even in Keith Ellison's case, he's the co-chairman of the Democratic Party, but he's half and half, and the half that's white is slave owning. So by the terms of his own plan, it's kind of like his left hand owes his right hand money.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to dig very deep into this plan at all to realize that there's just between the interracial mixing, the new immigration, the percent of whites who never even had slaves, the percent of blacks who've come here since slavery ended. Like people like President Barack Obama, who's a descendant of like a Kenyan who came here much more recently. Or you even have like wealth, like do like poor whites below the poverty lines owe Oprah Winfrey money, because one's white and one's black. So
in other words, this is logistically impossible, and the Democrats know it, and yet they're playing up on it anyway, because they really are more interested in just stirring up emotion than they are and in gaining votes and getting political support than they are in solving problems. So the idea that this would actually reduce racial tensions or racial disparities or inequalities in the United States is completely ludicrous.
Right, because by bringing it up, and there's definitely going to be Like I said, logistically or factually, there's just no way you could implement this. But emotionally, there is always going to be a fairly large part of the demographic that's kind of similar logic to like the Green New Deal. There's no way you could implement that either, but anyone who's against it must love pollution. Mm-hmm. So now you're like, oh, anyone who's against reparations must love slavery. And so you've driven a wedge into the electorate where a large number of people being like, this is morally unjustifiable, given that all slaves and slave owners have been dead for a good long time, and logistically impossible on the one side, and then on the other side being like, well, anyone who's against reparations must not be must think slavery is a good thing.
They're racist or white supremacist or white nationalists and so on and so forth.
Right, just stirring up emotions that are leading to some serious problems in the nation. I guess in the show notes we can put our editor-in-chief's article, Your Cities Are Burned with Fire, that goes through some of the prophecies in Isaiah, specifically Isaiah 1, talking about how your cities are burned with fire, strangers or devour them in your midst. And it's talking about this as a prophecy that God says, well, because the people have turned away from me, there's going to be race problems, mm-hmm. race problems in the nation. And we're definitely seeing race problems that had started to lie dormant or even go away as the decades rolled on after slavery ended, start to rear the head back up again here just in the last couple of years.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to Your Cities Are Burned with Fire and all of the other articles and the literature that we talked about on the program today. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Give us any feedback on today's show. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with the words of Benjamin Franklin. Nothing brings more pain than too much pleasure. Nothing more bondage than too much liberty. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.